Hello and welcome to another episode of the Successful Home Ownership Show with your host, Richard McKenzie, out of the greater Cincinnati areas. And this is the, like I said, the Successful Home Ownership Show, where we try to give you a lot of good information about being a successful homeowner, which stems from the very beginning of the process where you're using a real estate agent. A shout out to all of them out there, of course, in the greater Cincinnati area especially. And you're helping them, or they're helping you, I should say, pick out the right house according to the criteria, the price, the features that you want. And you're hoping that you can listen to a show like this and get some good information about how to avoid buying the wrong house, which would not otherwise inspect well. And today's episode, by the way, is gonna be Little House on the Rarity. Oh, did he actually say that? Yes, I did. So I'm dating myself. It's a play on words on the Little House on the Prairie, of course. And this is a rare house, therefore rarity. And the name of this show is so cute that you just want to keep listening. So, without further ado, let's get into this Little House on the Rarity. And why am I calling it that? Well, it is a little house, about 1,150 square feet. It does have a detached garage in the back. And it is in a little township area. I'm not going to say the name, but it is one of these areas that has 3-4-car garages up into the millions and has become an extraordinarily popular neighborhood, or a, not really a neighborhood as much as a township, town. It is incorporated above north of the greater Cincinnati area. And we do incorporate it and call it Greater Cincinnati Area. That being said, as I have mentioned in previous episodes, everything started when you have a river city. Everything starts from the river, okay, back in about 1800. And then you built out from there. And so anytime you built away from the river, something was a suburb. And then further away from that, a few hundred feet, a few thousand feet, became more suburb. And then more suburb and more suburb. So by the time you got way out, in about somewhere between 1955 and 60 when this house was built, there would have been huge tracts of land in between the houses. And this house was one of the early adopters in that area, very low population. I'd say this house is about 17 to 20 miles away from the city, riverfront of Cincinnati, and it would have been one of the very early adopters in the suburban area, way out from Cincinnati. So all river cities are similar to this, and in about that time frame, the other newer houses in this area, very popular area, help pull up the value. And of course, you realtors listening know these things too. They help pull the value. And of course, the rule on the street that you want, you never want to buy the biggest house on the street, because you want the other houses to pull your value up. You don't want to be the one that pulls everybody else up, because you'll, if you sell your house, you know, a lot of times you don't get the value that you put into it if you are the biggest house on the street. That being said, I'm getting into financial stuff more. I'd rather get into the home inspection and what were some of the things about this house that we inspected. And frankly, when you're looking for a house about this size, a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, very small ranch, what are some of the things you're going to be looking for in this age bracket, 1955 to 1960, to look out for? What are those things? There are unique features, of course. When this house was built, it was in that in-between area where they were building very quickly in the baby boom after the war. And a lot of houses, instead of having poured concrete, they had a masonry block foundation. This was one of them. And then they would put a parging coat or a skim coat on the outside to make the masonry look nice, to add it some texture. Now, this house did have full brick, meaning it actually did have structural brick, not brick veneer. which for 1955 to 60 was kind of rare, because that's about the time that they started the brick veneer. But this one missed that, which is good for the homeowner. And it has a one-car garage, an asphalt driveway. Typical things that the things that we care most about was, how does the land lay? And the older houses had the stone foundations or cut stone. Then you had some with masonry block, and in between the stone foundation and the masonry block, you had all the way up till the current poured foundation. Poured foundation and stone foundation being the strongest, and masonry block being not quite as strong as those. So water really does matter terrifically, a whole lot. It really matters. You want to keep water away from the house. So when we are inspecting the property, we're looking for areas that water can affect the foundation, and we're giving all kinds of advice to the buyer that if you're buying this house, it is imperative that all your gutters take the water away from the foundation, that the land is graded in a way on all sides, all four sides of the house, that it stays away from the house and water is incentivized to go away from the house. So that being said, on this particular house, on the left side, some bushes were taken out, and those bushes had been there since the house was built. And when those were removed, they left some depressions up against the house, because everything just kind of sinks down. And sometimes people put tons of mulch in thinking that's going to displace and create a nice little mound that's going to keep water away. Or maybe they're not even thinking about water. Probably not. That isn't good enough. You really want to add some topsoil and regrade it. So as we're educating the buyer, taking them around the house, showing them these things, we are definitely telling them that they're going to need to add some topsoil over there. And then on the back side of the house, where the air conditioner is, and underneath the deck, which had a lattice skirting nailed around all sides, so they're going to have to pull that off. And it had a whole lot, that's a technical amount, a whole lot of leaves underneath the deck, which there was a couple of very large oak trees, so they were all oak leaves, piled up underneath the deck, which just had gotten blown in there over time, and really need to be taken out of there so that those bunny rabbits and whatever else probably are in there have a new place to stay. And you want to fill those voids up against the foundation with more topsoil and slope it away from the house. Then you can put the lattice work back. And I suggested to him to put one of those pieces on a hinge so they can actually get in there if they need to in the future without having to rip it off the side of the deck. So again, think about the foundation type you have. If you do have a masonry block foundation, you can keep it from having structural cracks if you manage the property well and manage the water, more importantly, manage the water on the property well. This house really had what I consider a blessing of a foundation, in that there were no structural cracks noted. No horizontal typical cracks that you get with some masonry block foundations, because people don't really think about the water issue. Again, we're giving you lots of information on this episode, and agents, realtors, when you're taking your clients around, don't just go in the front door and look at the renovated house stainless steel appliances. Go down to the basement. Take them down to the basement. Make sure you're looking at the walls, and look for the big four that I've mentioned before: the air conditioner, furnace, the foundation, which is the walls, and the roof. And we'll cover those big four in this episode too, as it pertains to the little house on the prairie. Absolutely. Now, this had a unique unique characteristic outside. Okay, the land slightly sloped from the left front corner of the house gently towards the right, and the garage was a little bit lower, okay, than the right side of the house, so that when you went in the garage, you were down a little bit. The previous owner built up the entrance of the garage with asphalt really high, because the garage, the one-car garage floor, settled from the right to the left. And that water that got in there in heavy rains had nowhere to go. And you can see from the previous mud stains on the floor, which were cleaned really well, and there was just some previous mud stains that I don't think water had been in there in quite some time, because they had built the asphalt up so high that, quite honestly, you really couldn't drive into the garage normally and park your car, which may be why they built a two-car garage in the back. So it's not like we're prescriptive in our inspecting, but it's not to say we're stupid and we don't have any ideas of how to go about fixing that. So I did give the buyer and the family representatives with the individual some ideas of that I have seen. One would be cutting across the driveway with a 4 or 5 inch slot and putting a drain in the front of it so that water can get into that drain and be taken away from, and maybe even tied into the downspout for the gutter on the right front corner of the house, which actually would probably be a pretty simple solution, since that would only leave about a 2-foot to 3-foot connection point to that gutter downspout. That would be pretty handy dandy. And if you set it up right with the metal 3-foot long drain pieces, you can actually drive over that, because the metal grates that sit on top can be driven over, and that would be good. And some of that asphalt would need to be removed in the front to allow a natural entry of the garage. I just don't think that the owner probably thought through it enough and thought outside the box. Ideas like that. So that was something that we passed on, and everybody received that, I think, with open arms as far as that possible solution. Now, the roof, we went on the roof. It was a nice, easy to get on one from the rear deck, one story, hip roof, practically brand new. And it was important to note that a lot of times when you have a detached garage, the garage is left with the original roof on it, which was about 20 years old, maybe 17 to 20. But I think that probably was the same roof that was on the main house before the people who renovated the house, aka flipped it, replaced the main house roof but didn't replace the detached garage. So of course we give them the advice, or the observation, that that roof is going to be needing a replacement in the future, so budget for replacement in the future. Do we know how far in the future? No, we don't. Did we inspect to make sure we noted whether the roof was leaking or not? Yes, of course we did, and it was not leaking. And there were no missing shingles and obvious damage and those sorts of things. So we just gave them that input. Even the chimney on the roof didn't have any issues. And it was a pretty nice install, because there was some edge flashing, and that looked properly installed, and it had leaf guards, and the gutter downspouts were fully intact. There was one gap on one in between the downspout aluminum pipe and the drain, the PVC drain receiving it. And you may or may not know that they make these black PVC flexible connectors for those types of situations where you have those gaps, and it closes that gap so you don't have water missing the downspout. All right, then we did inspect the detached garage, and it had one issue with the garage door. Sometimes we tested it a few times and it went up, and then the next time we tested it went up, it didn't go up quite that far. Then the next time it went further. And that was a really strange thing. I've not really seen a garage door that didn't go up as high each time, which might mean there's some friction going on one of the rails with the wheels, and that needs an adjustment. A couple of open junction boxes, pretty nice actual foundation, and so that was pretty much what was left with the two-car detached garage. The yard, actually, in the backyard was nice and flat. As I mentioned, that more soil would need to be added to the backside of the house to keep water from going towards the back wall. And I would say most common to masonry block foundations that do have horizontal cracks, and this was not one of them, that crack tends to be on the rear of the house, mostly because that's where patios exist, and patios end up slipping, water gets in between the patio and the house, and the patio drops, and it ends up pushing on the back side of the house, and that's a lot of weight. So be very careful if you have a patio on the back side of a house with a masonry block foundation. It is important to handle that patio well and make sure that it is tipping away from the house gently so that water flows away from the house and that gap between that and the house is filled in and water does not have a chance to settle in there. Really, really, really important. Now, the backside of the house also has the air conditioner. So if you add topsoil around the air conditioner, you're going to end up maybe getting it the height of the pad that the air conditioner is sitting on. So the air conditioner actually is going to need to be raised up a couple, 3 inches also. That may put some stress on the coolant line and the other line, and therefore that may need to be done by a qualified HVAC technician so that you don't damage or break those lines or connections to the air conditioner. All right. Now, so then we inspected the garage, which actually had the attic access. Now, here's one of the noteworthy items for this particular inspection. In 1955 to 1960, sometimes you had rock mineral wool insulation, very rare to have some fiberglass insulation, but sometimes you had what's known as vermiculite insulation. What is vermiculite? Great question. Vermiculite is basically, it looks like shiny cat litter. Maybe the chunks are a little bit bigger, and it was a naturally occurring item that was mined in Libby, Montana, at a mine, and that insulation actually settles and it creates a nice heat transfer stoppage so that your attic is nice and cold in the winter and your house stays nice and warm. But that vermiculite in most cases contains asbestos fibers. Oh, so there's that word asbestos, which, as you know, the fibers in asbestos, when it is stirred up, when it is disturbed, can become friable, F-R-I-A-B-L-E, meaning airborne, and you can breathe those in, and that causes asbestosis, which leads to possible lung cancer, okay? So that needs to be remediated. What is remediation? Well, there's really two ways. One is to encapsulate the asbestos insulation by a qualified or licensed technician. The other would be removal by a licensed or qualified technician and then replaced. Fortunately, when we were at the house, it was noted that there was already a contract existing to replace this vermiculite insulation, and that looked appropriate. Hopefully, of course, they follow through on everything, and that becomes the case, and that's all well and good. So, where does that type of insulation fall? That basically occurs between 1955, 57, thereabout, and into the late 60s is when we found that. Another type of insulation that has been known to cause health issues would be formaldehyde. That would be this orange, bright orangish, and it's kind of that bright orange that's reminiscent of a 1970s color of kitchen countertops and so forth. And right around the early 70s is when we tended to find that as well. That would need to be removed as well by a qualified technician, and that would be more complicated because that stuff is kind of wedges its way in and sticks and fills voids and so forth, and probably would cost more than removing the vermiculite. So the other rooms in the house, all the outlets were tested because they were all accessible and all the windows were accessible. No furniture blocking anything. What was really nice about this house was the way that the electric was done, all except one particular situation, and I'll go into that. So as we're testing the outlets, I noted that one of the outlets that I tested was three prong, and then I saw that it was testing as if it was ungrounded. But then in the same room, I noted that there was a GFCI receptacle, and this is the den. You don't normally see GFCI receptacles in the den. So I put my tester in the outlet that was not the GFCI outlet, and then I tripped the GFCI, which, by the way, trips off of the neutral wire, not the ground wire. And pushing the button in to trip it is a valid test, as long as it trips and shuts off. What happened to the other outlet when I did that? Well, it showed that it had no power to it. That's fantastic. That means that somebody, an electrician, put in the GFCI solution for the ungrounded outlets. Why is that good? Well, it's not just good because it's in my own house, because my house is like 1951, but it's good because I've very rarely seen that when a renovator takes the time to actually implement the proper electrical solution instead of doing what I consider the lazy way and, well, we'll just go back and make all the outlets two-prong ungrounded, which is really kind of missing the whole point of the whole thing. You want to upgrade your outlets and make them safer, which is to say the equivalent of grounded or some approximate way of making sure the outlet shut off if there is a surge that goes through your house electric, which is what would happen in that case, because the GFCI receptacle in theory would trip and turn off the outlets. Great, so I really was happy to see that. Bathrooms and plumbing, all that stuff tested fine. Another noteworthy item as going through the kitchen appliances, this was really weird, and I would consider it a one-off, which needs a licensed electrician, further evaluation, and repair. Here's what happened. You have an electric stove glass top, and you have a microwave. Microwaves tend to be, in this case, about 1,200 to 1,500 watts, and it was on its own 20 amp breaker. Okay, nothing noteworthy about that, but the stove was on its own 40 amp breaker. Okay, nothing noteworthy about that. Notice I said its own. So the two separate appliances, two separate breakers. So why then, when you turned on the microwave and ran it, and then turned on one of the burners on the stove, would the microwave receptacle trip? Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have the answer either, which is why I called it out for further evaluation by a licensed electrician and repair as needed. That's the proper finding and the proper wording for that. All right, let's move on to the basement. So we've done all the bedrooms, basement, kitchen appliances, plumbing's doing well, ran the dishwasher. In the basement, we noted that the water heater was brand smackin' new. How long do those normally last? Good question. 15 to 20 years. What if you're a home inspector and you have a water heater? Shouldn't yours last longer? Nope. Mine lasted exactly 15, almost to the day. So I don't know. I really think in my house, mine should have lasted longer because I'm a home inspector. Kind of insulting that I get not the 20. No, I get the 15. That being said, as I digress, then we looked at the furnace and we ran it, testing it, and it was about 11, 12 years old, and the air conditioner outside, of course, was about 10 years old. They were a matched pair, but they were not installed at the same time, which I actually kind of like. I think as far as budgetary purposes, and folks out there, you know, you don't have to replace your air conditioner and furnace at the same time. Don't let somebody talk you into doing that. There should be about a five-year difference in the length of life, where the furnace should last about 5 years longer than the air conditioner. And so that's just for budgetary purposes. So agents, when we're talking about the big four and buyers, the big four being the air conditioner, furnace, roof, and the foundation, which are the four that can really kind of wreck your deal. Not the home inspector wrecking your deal, but just problems with one of those four can wreck your deal because you didn't see it coming, and it ended up being more than your out-of-pocket limit in a situation or scenario where you're in competitive bidding and you're trying to get the house and you end up with needing a new air conditioner because it didn't work and it was ancient, or a new roof, or a foundation crack that didn't come with a repair that had a transferable warranty. Those are all big issues that you need to watch out for, which is why you don't go in the house and look at the new windows and the smell of the polyurethane on the floor, and it looks beautiful and shiny as your kitchen appliances that are stainless steel, and the granite countertop is even sparkling. All that stuff is eye candy and is not going to trump a crack on a foundation or a roof, serious roof issue, or needing a new furnace or an air conditioner. So, all right, so I've gotten that off my chest on the Little House on the Rarey. And as we went around with the flashlight, really looking at the paint on the basement walls, looking to see if there was any areas where there was a hairline crack that maybe the paint looked thicker and maybe it was filled with some caulk and then painted over. Well, guess what? This house, which is why I call it a rarey, was not. It did not have any of those things. Can we be fooled by some of that stuff? Well, occasionally, but it's pretty hard if all the walls are not finished and they're open, they're easily accessible, you can look at them, get that flashlight at an angle and really look at all those masonry blocks and look at the straight lines and see if nothing's bowed, there's no gaps, that sort of thing. This house really had a nice foundation. The I-beam on it looked like there was no movement on it. The posts holding it up looked fine. It was a really well-built house. Didn't stink in the basement. Water main was easily available, all copper. So this house, you know, over time is going to be pretty low maintenance. After the topsoil is added and the grading improves, and hopefully the in front of the garage drainage is improved, and of course the weird microwave stove interaction thing going on there, I'm gonna have to talk to an electrician and run that one by him and find out myself, because it really just has me very curious as to why that happened. So hopefully this Realtors has given you some good information to help you be successful with your clients and to bid on the right house, not the wrong one, and enable you to get to the closing table also unencumbered and not have to start your sales pipeline over and have a happy client who picks out the right house and it inspects well. So until our next episode, and hopefully we find another rarey, this has been the Successful Home Ownership Show with your host, Richard McKenzie, out of the greater Cincinnati areas. If you have any pictures or questions that you want to send in, that's richard@firstinspections.com. Our website also is firstinspections.com. That is the numerical 1ST at the beginning, by the way. And until our next episode, thank you for listening.